We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
Television is reality, and reality is less than television.
All necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused.
Feature presentation, The Pause Button, with your host, Borzoi Boskovich.
You have been fined 6 credits for every racial slur that you have used before we started Jail. Welcome to The Pause Button. I am your host, Borzoi. And with me, as always, is Jail.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, I don't think I really have anything to preface this time. We're talking about Demolition Man. So I guess we can get right into it. As you like to always do, what's your recommendation on this movie, Jail?
Murder, death, kill me now.
I believe you also said this movie sucks a minimum of 12 dicks.
Yeah, at the same time, too. Not like one after the other, but like all 12 just at once.
Okay. I kind of liked it a little bit more than that. I think there's actually a number of interesting things in this movie that I found. So I guess like we can preface this by saying, if you've never heard of this movie, it's 1993. It's an action movie starring Sylvester Stallone. And
oh,
again,
you stole my joke that I stole from a different guy. Fuck you.
Yeah, we will be covering for every Jew that was involved in this movie.
Yeah.
But starring alongside Wesley Snipes, and this movie's kind of notable. It probably would have been a forgettable action movie if it weren't for a number of things in this movie that's, you know, quote unquote predicted the future. But watching it now, I think it predicts more than people kind of realize. There's very piss earth tones to this movie, especially, or like at the very least, kind of like I saw a bit of technological accelerationism present in this movie.
I don't know, man. I see what they were doing. Like, oh, look, this character, Sandra Bullock, her character's name is Huxley in this future dystopia. Isn't that clever? Get out of here. I don't know, dude. This movie was made in 93.
Yep.
And I was in middle school and I feel like I wrote it. Like, all of these sort of tough guy quip one-liners and stuff are so corny. Like, I can't, all it would bring to mind is Michael Scott's Michael Scarn FBI, for anyone who watched The Office. It sounds like it was written by a middle schooler. Like, none of this it's just so corny, man. This is cornier than 400 miles of Iowa. I was even going to take down some of the lines, and I just couldn't. I was like cringing too hard to type them out. Like, at one point they kill this dude and throw him on a fire, and they're like, well, I guess his plan went up in smoke. And that's the whole movie, is just one after another of those, or hacky, silly, what will people sound like in the future sort of language. Like, they have their own kind of double speak, but it's not clever. It's like no thought was put into it. Again, like a middle schooler wrote it.
Well, okay, you're not wrong. You're not wrong on these points. The worst parts of the movie for me, like, if you like corny action movies, then you'll probably like Demolition Man, just for the that kind of stuff alone. If you really like the, especially when it's played straight, unironically, just how these awful, awful action one-liners. Some of them don't even make any sense sometimes. I remember watching, it's like, that, why, like, Simon says die. It's like,
yeah.
Why is that the line you went with? Like, in this moment, what was the purpose of that? But I think, well, the stuff obviously people are going to want us to talk about is the futuristic stuff today. It's not just because Sandra Bullock's name is, you know, Huxley, which is the thing is, like, I found that to be the most perplexing part of it because it's very on the nose, but it doesn't, they don't do any of the kind of the proper, I think whoever wrote this didn't understand Brave New World. Like, I feel like they had a very, like, not even a surface level understanding of Brave New World, or maybe it's just they were a fan of the book and they wanted
to throw like a reference. It's like a high school sophomore explained Brave New World to somebody, and then that person tried to write a movie.
Because it's not even really about, like, it's just, it's, I could do all my stuff about this movie without having to make a Brave New World comparison, because there's really no reason for me to do so. I think it's also because our existence, like, the kind of stuff that Brave New World was, if you want to say predicting what Brave New World was describing, a lot of that has just kind of become part of our existence anyway. So it's kind of hard to, like, because it's so normalized, that's kind of like the piss earth thing, really. I guess, like, since this is my very first note right here, I wrote down a future shit, piss earth. And I think I got piss earth from you. I guess this is a good time to explain what piss earth is. Yeah. Like, I actually got the piss earth because for people who know, who are aware, there's a one of those popular pieces on American Sun, an online magazine, is Piss Earth 2025, which was written by me. It's actually made quite a few rounds. And people have said that the meme comes from me, which is understandable considering I was a big part of popularizing it. But I actually got it from you, Jaya, when you were talking about in reference to that one movie. What was it? Like the one
Assassination Nation.
Yes. Like, so where did you come up with Piss Earth, or did that come from somebody else?
Piss Earth from a meme. And it's like three or four little kids, and two of them give like sort of normal kid quotes. It's like, Jacqueline is 9 years old. And then it has a quote from Jacqueline of like, I like to play on the swings with my brother and eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And then the next kid has a similar one. And then Jackson, age eight, says, world is fuck. Bomb every jungle, piss earth 2025.
I didn't even know the origin of that.
No, that's what it is. World is a...
Oh, world is a fuck?
There's four lines, though. It's like, world is a fuck. Bomb every jungle, I don't give a frick. Piss earth 2025. I'll dig the meme out and we can even...
You know what's so funny about that? Okay, I found the meme, actually. I'll post this in for Franklin. Here's the funny thing about all that. Like, I didn't know that's where that came from. So when I wrote Piss Earth 2025, I actually incorporated another version of the world as a fuck meme into that piece. And I didn't even know that's where it came from. Yeah, here it is right here. I have it now.
Because what I did...
World is a toilet. I do not give a fuck. Bomb every jungle, piss from 2025.
There you go.
That's amazing.
And I saw that when I, you know, saw Assassination Nation, and I sort of contextualized the 2025. This was before we had lost all hope in Trump. And it was whatever comes when Trump leaves office. Like, this is clown world. And if you think this is bad, piss earth is what happens when they elect a, you know, gay Jew tranny with AIDS or whatever in 2024 who will take office in 2025.
Yeah. And at least the way that I've conceptualized the piss earth meme to me, like, it was building on that, where clown world is honk honk honk, like, you know, the kind of thing of like, look how ridiculous this is. Like, when you have something like, oh, there's a terrorist attack in Europe, so that means we need to let in more refugees. Like, that's clown world to me, like, where the absurdity is just so apparent, all you can do is laugh at it because it seems like it's a joke that's being run, and, you know, the world's being run by clowns. Pisser to me is like where the stuff becomes so normalized, like you don't even think twice about it anymore. Like it just seems normal to you, more or less. It's like oh no, I almost misgendered that person. I gotta be careful, otherwise I might lose my job, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where it's like it's just become an everyday part of your being in life. And that's like I was getting kind of shades of that piss earth feeling when watching this movie. Like it's they don't manage kind of that aspect of it very well because it's played very jokey and very hokey in the movie. But like this is when you think about some of the stuff, some of the aspects in this movie, you can see it. Like, you know, if you try to give the movie more credit than it's due, you can see kind of those terrifying aspects of what a future like that would look like.
Yeah, I think that this movie can largely be summed up. So I am on the border of I'm like the Zillennial, right? I am on the border between Generation X and Millennial. And I was wondering like who. So obviously this movie is rated R. It wasn't targeted at children. So who could like dialogue that is this corny and childish? And we tend to use the word boomer as just meaning like old person, but you have to remember this is a generation and there was a time when they weren't old. Well, this movie was this whole genre of these corny action movies from this time that, you know, there were so many of the movies and so many of the stars that now they've done three piss takes in the form of the Expendables, also starring Sylvester Stallone, and Wesley Snipes is in one or two, maybe all three of those. I think he was in prison when the first one was made for tax evasion. But this has all of the vapidity of boomers with sort of the nihilism of Xers. And for being a movie that was, you know, sort of targeted at the 18 to 35 demographic or whatever for 1993, I think that's a lot of what I'm seeing here. And that couldn't be better contextualized by having Dennis Leary. This is not long after his No Cure for Cancer CD came out.
Yeah.
It was this, you know, it was a hit comedy, stand-up comedy record. And a lot of the material was stolen from a guy called Bill Hicks who died of lung cancer.
Yeah.
And
I can actually go on about that because I was a huge Bill Hicks fan, but yeah.
He goes into this rant at the end of there's also a song, maybe two songs on that CD.
The asshole song.
Right. And the end of the asshole song is, again, all of the sort of decadent vapidity of boomers and all of the nihilism of Xers. And he goes into a rant all too similar to the end rant from his song. He does this thing about how he's going to, you know, drive his Cadillac down the road, getting 3 miles to the gallon. He's going to eat his Big Mac in the styrofoam container, throw it out the window and wipe his mouth with the American flag. Cause this is America, baby. And we could do what we want.
Yeah, I got it. I have it right here. Frank, go ahead and play it from about 2 minutes and 40 seconds while you're pulling that up. Yeah. It was grating on my nerves. Cause I knew Dennis Leary was in this movie, but I had never seen this movie before because I was a kid when it first came out. And it was just one of those things I never went back and watched, but okay. It looks like he's got it pulled up. Go ahead and play it.
With whale skin hubcaps and all leather cow interior and big brown baby seal eyes for headlights. Yeah! And I'm gonna drive around in that baby at 115 miles per hour, getting 1 mile per gallon, sucking down quarter pound of cheeseburgers from McDonald's in the old-fashioned non-biodegradable styrofoam containers. And when I'm done sucking down those greaseball burgers, I'm gonna wipe my mouth with the American flag, and then I'm gonna toss the styrofoam containers right out the side, and there ain't a goddamn thing anybody can do about it. You know why? Because we got the bomb.
Yeah, that's why. Like... Yeah, we don't like. He goes on and on about basically with an America fuck yeah thing that we're going to bomb all of you if you try to even, you know, try to stop us from this horrible consumptive lifestyle. Basically, that's exactly like because like there's actually a great like what Dennis Leary's character should be representing with the scraps is this like this part of humanity that desires freedom, the desire to to struggle, to engage in the power process, to have autonomy. Like, there's like, if this movie were to be written, like, the premise of this movie is actually really great. Now, written by somebody who knows what they're doing and is smart, like, this could have been fantastically written. And you could have a character like Dennis Leary who, like, he recognizes, like, the danger of having to live your life on your own terms because of, like, you know, especially like how they're on the outs and everything. But you know, the argument he comes up with is that you should have the only freedom that matters is the freedom to engage in horrifically decadent and self-indulgent light and consumptive lifestyles, which is like, which is present in that song that we just played.
Well, there were that album, his whole shtick to this day. Yes, it has the boomer decadence and Generation X nihilism, but this was a weird time. I talk all the time about the end of when history stopped. History stopped between the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of Soviet communism, and 9/11. And the world was kind of trying to find its way. We felt like we had no enemies, that we had won the Cold War. So you have the rah-rah patriotism still hanging over in this early 90s time period of having won that. And you also have the introduction of PC culture, because now there was no external enemy. So it was sort of like, let's look inside and clean house. And that's where sort of snowflakes started. And guys like Leary were raging against that. Environmentalism was becoming a thing. This is the time of the first Iraq war ending and then Bill Clinton getting elected. And people are talking about the ozone layer and recycling. A lot of young cats probably don't remember a time that this wasn't normal. And that's why that also goes back to the conversation about Piss Earth. Piss Earth is the normalization of clown world. Well, we had certain aspects of clown world starting in this early 90s period, and the response was Dennis Leary dressing up as George Patton and singing songs about, you know, littering on purpose. And whereas I, you know, after the revolution, I want my job to be litter cop. I understand his rage toward that sort of package deal behavior of like the PC people and the green police. He just sort of was the expression of all that.
There's so much I want to talk about on this topic alone, because this movie comes at that, like, that time period that you're talking about. Just like a quick thing, like, you're talking about the PC culture, like, you can see expressions of what this movie really wants to talk about, but they're not either it was probably a combination of the writer not being talented and director not being talented enough to draw that out of it, and also they weren't going to go there. But like the whole being fined for swearing, like, what that really should have been and what makes a lot more sense is being fined for dropping racial slurs or in politically incorrect language. Like, that is like when you think about the time period this came out, and like that's exactly what, like, that's the, what the true expression of that was. And that's like, that's the same on that same level. Like, everything that Leary is ranting about in this movie is a very neutered, it's basically a neutered expression of what, you know, like kind of like the reactionary impulses of the American male was feeling. We have to remember, like, these action movies are male movies. They're, you know, this is like, these are movies for red-blooded American males. And so it's always interesting to see, like, what messaging is coming out of that. I have a number of things to talk about with that, but this movie came out in 1993, so there's a number of weird things going on with this. You have, and what you were saying about this is, like, I think what's going on here, because this is tying in with the cheesy one-liners and all of that. What I think is going on here is not only is it the end of history, it's like, at that point, what do you do? Because what were action movies about before? It's usually about, like, you know, you were fighting, like, the Russians or the Arabs or the Cubans or, like, basically some expression of either Islamic terrorism or communism. Or commies, like that. But so once the Cold War was over, like, the action movie still has to exist. But here's the funny thing: they became meta, and there were two movies that were playing off each other that came out the same exact year: Demolition Man and The Last Action Hero, both 1993 movies, and they both reference the other big name action hero in in those movies. So you have in Demolition Man, they talk about President Schwarzenegger. He's, you know, like, and they make a very explicit reference to him. Like, he's a real thing. Like, in this universe, Arnold Schwarzenegger is a thing. Sylvester Stallone presumably isn't. Well, they have the same thing going on in Last Action Hero. Go ahead and pull that clip up, Frank, the Last Action Hero clip. When they're at the movie store, people probably already know what it's going to be, but go ahead and play that.
It's funny. Oh, go ahead.
So you have Stallone as Terminator.
It isn't possible.
What's not possible? He's fantastic. This is his best performance ever.
But that was you. You were in that movie. You were in a movie.
You can stop it right there. They don't go any further than that. But it's like you have these meta references, and action movies were becoming much more meta and self-referential. I really like The Last Action Hero. I think it's actually a fantastic movie. I know Sven's done a bit about that because of what happens at the end of the movie, but it's a movie that plays meta very well. But like this is my point. But the point of all this is there was nowhere for action movies to go but become more self-referential. So you have two different expressions of that. You have The Last Action Hero, which just goes completely like, we are aware that we are an action movie and we're going to do a postmodern action movie, basically. And then on the other hand, you have Demolition Man, which is like, action movies are inherently ridiculous, so let's play that up to 11, more or less. Like, I don't know, like, to what extent that was the full intention behind it, but that's the expression of it that comes out in this movie. It's like, let's just turn this up to 11 and make right. this a very ridiculous action movie. And the only way like we can make it even more ridiculous is like, let's fling this guy into the future and we'll make a bunch of hokey stuff about like how bizarre and weird the future is.
Yeah. And, you know, they're in the weirdo future, but the main character is sort of a history buff and she loves, you know, 20th century stuff. And she actually has like a Lethal Weapon poster.
Yeah.
In her room. And so obviously like the concept of the movies exists, and it's also worth mentioning that they offered Stallone's role first to Steven Seagal and Jean-Claude Van Damme, who also starred in several of these same sort of boilerplate action movies.
Oh man, Van Damme would have been great in this movie.
Yeah. And they offered Wesley Snipes' role to Jackie Chan, who also gets name dropped in the movie.
Well,
the girl who likes 20th century stuff all of a sudden becomes like strong women and can like beat up guys. So it should be noted that this future is so pacifistic that people literally don't touch each other. They don't have sex. There hasn't been an act of violence in 30 years. And suddenly she knows how to whip ass, and it's because she had watched Jackie Chan movies. But the corniest thing about that fight scene, and this is just a quick aside, she wins the fight by kicking him in the balls, where you can clearly see that he is wearing an external cod piece. This has so many of those tropes of like chick kicks dude in balls, or it had, you know, like every other movie, Stallone has to blow stuff up to save people, and then like the supervisor cop is like, damn it, Stallone, you're a loose cannon. Like, you better come down to my office immediately. They do that whole thing, and like guns that never run out of ammo. Like, why did they keep loaded guns in the museum? Well, and like tons of ammo.
And I have to think that the filmmakers aren't that dumb, like that they must have been, like, which is why I think that they're playing this to be as ridiculous as possible. And they do kind of make some almost on the nose things about there are some other postmodern aspects to this as a postmodern action movie, because like the point you brought up where like she's able to do all this kung fu because she's been watching movies, like she's obsessed with the 20th century, she's been watching movies. Like, simulation is a huge aspect of this movie. She lives entirely through media, and like she worships what's his name? We'll just say Stallone's character. She worships Stallone's Spartan, John Spartan. She worships, I mean, like, they have these on the nose names like John Spartan and Phoenix and all that. Like, they are like, they are aware of like how ridiculous this movie is. She worships John Spartan as an action hero, but within the context of this movie, he's supposed to be a real person who, you know, who functioned as an actual human being. Well, she treats him as a action, as her own personal action hero, and consumed his life as her own personal media, in addition to all the other media.
Right.
And they're kind of like, there is like very Baudrillard, like this is like what's weird, like this is what's so interesting about this movie in the time period it came out, because like, again, this is right after both the Gulf War and the LA riots, and like you have within 3 years after the LA riots, like that LA has become a war zone, which is why they started out, like they've escalated things to basically being like a full on military conflict within the country, and are employing these new things. But on the Gulf War thing, you have like Baudrillard's, I don't think these guys were reading Baudrillard, but like Baudrillard's famous piece is "The Gulf War Never Happened." And Rick Roderick has going alongside the whole simulation thing where these people aren't even having sex, like that this is the war of the irreal versus the real. Rick Roderick kind of explains like a lot of this stuff. Like when I saw that scene of them having virtual sex, I immediately thought of this lecture. Go ahead and pull that one up, Frank, and play it from the timestamp that I gave you. It's going to be a couple minutes, but it's well worth listening to.
The war zone, in other words, may not be, in defending the self, may not be any one of the classical ones, like the working class versus the ruling class, the slaves against the masters, oppressed women against a patriarchal society, blacks against whites. No, the struggle in the future may be to maintain the real against the unreal, or the hyperreal, or the irreal. The desire for experience, and this is, I'm trying to kind of be upbeat about the situation that we're in. The desire for experience is also the experience for, is also a desire for a kind of experience. What I mean by that is this, that even in these rather, you know, the rather hopeless picture I painted of the young, there remains something like a curiosity about what experience would be like if I could have one. And there is an absolute extremism everywhere about how far people will go to try to have a genuine experience, if I can still use the word genuine, you see, because again, the language has been polluted by this very movement that I've been describing. Say genuine, you'll think about a genuine beer or genuine boots or a genuine, you know, cowboy hat or whatever. No, a genuine experience, an authentic experience, a real experience. The battle lines may be between anonymous forces of, that have been unleashed by a technology that grew out of capital, that will be controlled in the hands of not many people, perhaps, perhaps not, I mean, we don't know, and people who still would like to have some experience. This wouldn't make them archaic old fuddy-duddies if they said, hey, look, honey, why not tonight? Why don't we really make love, the two of us, instead of getting in our virtual reality sex machines? That may become a revolutionary move in the near future. It may be.
Okay, it may become. So yeah, that's like everything he's describing. That is Demolition Man right there, and that's like Demolition Man's a very inelegant, very dumb expression of that. Yeah. But like that is like, I mean, like it, the movie ends with him teaching Huxley to have that genuine that genuine moment of love. Like let's actually kiss, let's actually have sex, instead of engaging in this plastic environment that you guys have embraced as your own. Like that's like, this is what I mean about being about Demolition Man being a postmodern action movie, where they have these little themes that are going on in the background, while dialing up how ridiculous and dumb it is as an action movie. This is why I think I said I might have liked the movie better more than you did, because I actively was looking for stuff that I could enjoy in it, I think.
Yeah. No, and I saw them sort of serving up those takes. I just think this was a really silly way, ham-fisted way to try and sell me those takes. The only thing I felt was clever about this, and tell me what you think, because the reason for that quote that we just listened to is they don't have sex in this world. They put on like virtual reality helmets, and they'll see like flashes of the other person's face as it sort of, fires electrodes into your brain that make you have like feel sexual pleasure or whatever. I thought, because there's the scene where she refuses to kiss him, because there's, so they put the helmets on and he's like, no, screw this. Let's do it the real way. She's like, ew, that's gross. People don't do that anymore. He tries to kiss her and she's like, you know what? Get out of my apartment. So he leaves. I thought that was going to be a setup for us finding out that she is his long lost daughter that he was talking about.
You thought they were going to do like an old boy thing here?
Yeah. Like, we narrowly missed having like sexual contact with each other. You know, woo, that was a close call because it turns out you're my daughter.
Yeah, that's a weird thing that they set up the thing with the daughter that doesn't have like any payoff in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that's
because you could totally see them sort of setting it up to be her because that's why she's so fascinated by him. That's why she's the only person with any rebellion in her, is that, you know, she would be carrying his genes.
This movie with like the premise and then like a rewritten script done by a more transgressive director would have, like, this could have been like a futuristic old boy or something even darker, especially when they kind of go on the more like dystopian aspects of this movie. But unfortunately it kind of lingers too much on the action movie angle and it doesn't really become what it could have been, which is kind of sad to be honest, because like there's like this movie has a lot of potential to it. I think it's like, again, like if you want a dumb action movie, it's enjoyable. But a couple of the things I have on this as well, I guess, like talking about action movies themselves, I have this note I wrote down here because like they play the cowboy cop thing straight in this movie, and the cowboy cop trope is very it's a very popular American trope, and I think it's an expression, like, again, drink if every time I use the word expression, I think it's an expression of how Americans we're a very frontier minded people, how we chafe at the way the system is set up and just how fundamentally the system is against accomplishing anything. And we understand that on an implicit level, like the bitching comes out and like how criminals are not like are given like a light touch and all that. And it's always put in this frame because like you can't talk about the actual issues that affect America. You can't talk about the racial anxiety that's endemic to the American experience. We can't talk about any of that stuff. So the way it comes out has to come out in these very bizarre ways. That's where you get like this kind of like boomerism. Boomerism is what happens when you condition people so thoroughly in a consumer minded atmosphere with kind of like the remaining vestiges of all Americanism, but without being able to talk about the actual diversity issues of America.
Yeah. And it's funny because in this era, we had another thing sort of creeping into the mainstream, and that was like hip hop and gangster rap culture. And they attempted something so silly, it's almost beyond words, which is the score. Whenever it's a Wesley Snipes scene, it goes from being sort of like classical heroic stuff to being like record scratches and like hip hop horn blast samples. Like whenever he's fighting or talking, it sounds like the opening to like Brass Monkey.
Yeah. Well, they cast Wesley Snipes, the blackest nigga in Hollywood.
Right.
Like they couldn't, like, I mean, like, again, like I know, like, okay, so yeah, Stallone is, yeah. But I mean, considering that these movies were primarily made and marketed to white, you know, red-blooded American males, that somebody like Wesley Snipes with the kind of musical light motifs they give for him, the musical cues and like how dark he is, like they, like that, it really does set up that kind of like, it's meant to trigger kind of that American racial anxiety and that friend enemy distinction that Americans have, like until recently, Americans have always kind of really felt, like, especially in the boomer generation.
Yeah. I mean, and like, I'm sure if they would have cast Jackie Chan every time he spoke, it would have been dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, that's like, I think that's why some of the, like, why this movie seems kind of really cartoonish to guys like you and me, like from the generations that we're from, like, because I've watched movies with my dad. My dad's a young boomer, but I've watched movies with my dad. Like he's aware. I mean, like it's not like he's gonna watch them like this, and he's not gonna see like how stupid it is. But like, there's more of a a level of acceptance, I guess, would be a way of putting it. Like, it's the entertainment is like the way that these things are presented on a visceral level, it appeals more to that generation, like in a way I'm not going to be able to do a good job of explaining. Mm-hmm. Part of it, I guess, is like because we're a much more jaded generations, and we're more self, like not self aware, like we're more.
No, we are more self-aware.
We're more post-modern, here's like, and actually Rick Roderick talks about this stuff, because Rick Roderick was a boomer himself. Like boomers are modern, are modernists. We're postmodernists, and you can see like that generational strife. Like, I'm just trying not to be mean to boomers right now, but you can see that generational strife. Like, we are much more postmodern generations, and we don't engage with this media the same way that the boomers do, basically.
Yeah, boomers were always willing to go along to get along and be told what to do, because everything always worked out for them. They were handed this great, awesome world that they have squandered for us. So they don't question anything. That's why if you're talking about a Republican or a Democrat, if you criticize their positions, like we've all seen how they respond to it. So these are the same people who aren't going to criticize stuff like Wesley Snipes holding a blowtorch like an inch above a giant pool of gasoline and it's not exploding yet because he hasn't actually like touched the lighter to it, or guns with endless bullets, or this has one of my favorite like shitty movie gun trope things where as someone is like talking shit to the other guy, he cocks his gun like 4 or 5 times. Like, what device are you using on that? And of course, like, boomers don't call this stuff into question. They just sort of take whatever was put in front of them.
Yeah, I guess this is a good way for me to segue into my other note I had here, was like, because like I see 1993, I see movies like Last Action Hero and Demolition Man as the beginning of the end of the action movie, or I guess like the classical action movie, as it were, because like once you start getting into self-referential and postmodern kind of breaking the fourth wall type of filmmaking, there's really nowhere else to go once you start deconstructing the action movie.
Well, and you know what else kills this kind of thing is the same thing that like killed crappy sitcoms and crappy network television is people actually started to like make good movies and give a fuck. And then everyone who was pouring out schlock is like, whoa, 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 don't do that. You're ruining it for everyone else. We didn't have to put any effort in for a whole generation. And then you get something like, I don't know, maybe The Matrix comes out, and you can't make these schlock Van Damme, Steven Seagal, Stallone, Bruce Willis, you know, all the old heads, Dolph Lundgren. Pretty much the cast of The Expendables were put out of work. And that's sort of the whole idea of The Expendables, is that Stallone is getting the gang back together because all of those guys were put out of work by people deciding to make good movies again.
Well, yeah, there's that. And well, so I could be wrong on this, because like, this is where me not being like a cinephile is gonna like comes back to bite me in the ass, because I'm trying to remember what the progression of movies were. Because like, this is like, somebody in the chat had a great point, like The Last Action Hero, which I, again, like if you're just tuning in, I like The Last Action Hero. I'm actually a big fan of that movie. But like The Last Action Hero and movies like Demolition Man were kind of in a way a goodbye to the classic white action hero, like the one that's really, you know, built and jacked and everything. I think if I'm not mistaken, like you started to see a decline of this stuff in the 90s, and the 80s has always been kind of seen as the classic action hero era anyways. Then you have The Matrix. I'm glad you brought that one up, because I completely forgot about that one. Then the action movies started to move into a different direction starting in 1999, where it became more science fiction and more comic book, especially because the special effects were starting to catch up, and practical effects were not as, like, at least in the industry, practical effects were not as prized and treasured, because computer graphics and computer effects were seen as the way of the future. So The Matrix,
well, this stuff got attacked from both sides. Actually, I'm going to push back just a little bit on there, or maybe just add to what you said. Yes, special effects took over, but they were attacked from a different angle as well with practical effects by having real martial artists, and mostly non-white. Like, once you started to get Jackie Chan, Jet Li, and the fight scenes were much more intricate, much more interesting. It wasn't just like guys throwing haymakers and body slamming each other. It was this really neat looking new thing. Yeah. So on the practical side, you had stuff like Jackie Chan, and then on the technical side, you had stuff like The Matrix, and these guys couldn't keep rehashing these same, like, I don't know, rogue cop movies. And
I can take that and build upon that. I mean, part of this is that whole, like, and, you know, we say it's not the end of history, it was the pausing of history, but like this whole end of history thing, like it was kind of like, again, like it's not just the effects side of things. Like, you didn't have guys who looked like Stallone or
Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, you had that, and so like the kung, like, you know, that's actually why The Matrix makes a good mark for this. Like, there's actually two movies I would say like that change, like that changed the progression of all of this. You had The Matrix, where you had these much more live, even when the guys were white, like they're much more live, they're more kung fu oriented, because you had, and then like it's not just because the Jackie Chan movies were popular. Like, I mean, Jet Li was a big part of that. I remember Romeo Must Die was a popular 2000 kung fu movie. Like, you had that more choreography that was coming out, but then you also had in 2000 the first X-Men movie, and I would say that kind of changed everything. And that's like, I know in the 2000s that as popular as comic book movies were, they weren't as popular as they were going to become in this decade with the Marvel stuff, because like, that blew everything away. But this was like the aughts was the rise of the comic book movie, and with and going alongside kind of like the more kung fu oriented movies and the shape that the action hero was changing. That's where you start. Like, that's like where you see how the action movie really began to change, and it evolved into this Bugman comic book thing and the extended universes and all that. Like, that's where you, like, all this stuff moved. Now, the reason why I'm talking about all this, because I wanted to mention this, I asked you about this. I have not seen any of the John Wick movies past the first one, and I didn't really, like, only half paid attention to that. But I do understand with the popularity of the John Wick things that it's just, it's pure masculine action. And like just strong, like just some of the most amazing choreography that can be in an action movie. It seems to me like we're starting to see kind of a reconstruction of an action movie where, like, let's take what actually makes an action movie good and just make it that.
Yeah. Like, okay, so my concept is Demolition Man. Why not just do it well? Make it good. Do it not hokey. And that's what you get from John Wick. John Wick has, you know, big explosions and stuff, but it also has really technical martial arts. There is a scene in this third one, and I'm not really spoiling anything here, but John Wick and several Asian guys throw like a million fucking knives at each other. And they're just like catching them and throwing them back. And then one guy gets one in the heart, and he, you know, it goes on and on. And it had to take them days to shoot this like 3-minute scene. I want to see that kind of effort. And when I watched Demolition Man, no effort was really put into the action sequences. No effort was put into the script. I feel talked down to, like, hokey costumes, you know, hokey dialogue. So then you get something like The Expendables, which is a piss take on these sorts of movies. You know, they're all older and they make lots of self-referential jokes, because there was some nostalgia for this ham-fisted, hit you over the head style, you know, you don't have to think sort of action movie. And that sort of Stallone, because he wrote, produced, directed the Expendables movies, that's him being willing to critique himself. And the response to that critique is stuff like John Wick, these modern, well-executed action flicks. But even now, I think we're going to start to see a serious overflood of John Wick-style movies. There was already Atomic Blonde, and I don't remember what it was called. and it's not actually set in the John Wick universe, but one of the movies for which there was a trailer when we went to go see John Wick was essentially John Wick the Woman.
I was gonna say what's gonna happen is they're gonna completely miss the point of why the John Wick movies are popular. I mean, like, you have that, like, it's always nice to see, like, when the you know, when the woke left, like, complains about things, because they actually tend to be more right on this stuff than at least, like, the average, like, boomer kind of, like, the average, like, I don't see
Republican.
I don't see anything you're talking about kind of conservative or person who just doesn't want to be paying attention to anything, because they understand exactly the problematic appeal of a John Wick movie. I mean, like, it's in that, you know, that meme about John Wick 2, that there's only one woman in it and she kills herself.
Yeah,
or something to that effect.
40 minutes in, no women, because there is another woman, but she's mute. So the meme is like, no woman talks until 40 minutes into the movie. Then she says five words and kills herself. No more women speak.
I mean, like, they are aware of how, in their view, like, how unbearably masculine these movies are, and that's the problem with them. So that's why they're going to be trying to do this Atomic Blonde stuff, or they're going to do John Wick but black, and then eventually they're going to do John Wick but transgender, and then John Wick.
And nobody's going to go watch those. And then there's going to be articles about how incredibly racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic it is that nobody went to go see those. But, like, I don't know, other than a handful of butch lesbos, like, do women really give a shit? Like, it's still men who turn out for female-centered action movies. Because of the activism angle on it, you might have had a little bit different effect with Captain Marvel, but, like, the majority of the Hunger Games fans are male. And I read those books and liked them. I liked those movies well enough. I didn't think any of it was spectacular, but it was good. But action stuff is always going to be a male thing, and guys want to imagine themselves as the dude, like, especially when you're young. Like, I had an ex-girlfriend in my 20s who jokingly would set limits to how many action movies I could watch and how many kung fu movies I could watch, because for 3 hours after the movie, you're kung fuing the shit out of anything that comes within 20 feet of you. First thing you do if you're 25 years old and you walk out of John Wick with your buddies is you all square up and start kicking the shit out of each other. And then you're at home and, like, the dog looks at you and you, like, you know, cop the crane position, you know, like, you're going to kung fu your dog or whatever. Guys want to imagine themselves as the action character. They don't want to imagine themselves as Charlize Theron.
Have you ever seen the Tony Jaa movies?
No.
Yeah. So he's a Thai martial artist, and, like, in the aughts, his movies were I think was it Tony Jaa? So his movies were always about the selling point of his movies. Let me collect my thoughts here. The selling point of his movies is, like, there was no, like, it was all real. Like, they didn't use, like, choreographed effects or anything like that. So, like, this is, like, real martial arts kind of stuff. And his most famous movie at the time was Ong Bak. We went, so that's Tony Jaa. My friends and I went and saw his next movie, The Protector, in theaters, and then we went back to our dorm room and we watched Ong Bak. And then we had been drinking, we went outside our dorm and just started kicking the shit out of each other. Yeah. Next half hour,
doing sound effects while you're doing it.
I got a foot right to the face from a spinning kick. men when they watch action movies and drink, like, this is like a disaster waiting to happen. I remember one of my friends was, like, walking. No, it was me. This happened to me. Like, I started walking down the steps of the dorm, and one of my friends basically ran to the top of the stairs, jumped on top of me, tried to kick me. He hit me just enough to smack me into the wall, but he kept going and hit the wall even faster. Our friend had just started walking down the steps, and when he saw that, he fell down the steps laughing. Just three drunk morons just kicking the shit out of each other for an hour.
On a flight of steps. What could possibly go wrong?
Because we'd watch a couple of Thai action movies.
Yeah. No, that's how it works. Or like you get cut off from watching too many mob movies because you start talking like them.
Yeah, pretty much.
You start doing like gangsterisms and doing the accent, and like your girlfriend or your wife will look at you and you're like, what, am I funny to you? You know, or there's a pen sitting there, so you just gravitate toward the Pesci. Is this your pen scene? It's funny the way this sort of meathead shit where it rubs off on us.
Yeah.
But well, again, the point being that you want to imagine yourself as that guy. And you can even go back to like Shaft and Dolomite and the blaxploitation movies, and they had a place in America because all the black dudes wanted to be able to imagine themselves as the guy who kicks ass. And, you know, they didn't see themselves in Chuck Norris. There's a reason why guys like Jet Li and Jackie Chan are so wildly popular back at home. And our action movies are really popular over there too. But, you know, they want to see their own guy.
Yeah. Well, that's that actually brings me to a note I had. Like, the one thing that actually that pissed me off in this movie, and because in my view, it was played too seriously. It wasn't like, she's not, I don't know, like, do you remember when he meets up with that old black guy that he knew back before he got frozen?
I had this in my notes to run with it. Yeah.
Yeah. And Huxley, Sandra Bullock, what was the note I exactly had on this? Oh, insecure heterosexual males socialize with friendly physical contact. She refers to it as being insecure heterosexual males. And that's like, you know, they're insecure because of how they engage with like physical affection with each other.
Well, it's physical affection and vulgarity.
Yes.
Because, you know, so what's Stallone's character's name? Spartan. John Spartan. Yeah,
John Spartan.
Spartan had been cryogenically frozen for 39 years after being framed for killing a bunch of innocent people in an explosion that actually Wesley Snipes, a psychopathic criminal, had killed. They were hostages. Snipes took these hostages, and Stallone went to go save them. He had already killed them, so he doesn't see any thermal signature for these people, so he blows up the building because it's only full of bad guys. Turns out the dead bodies of the hostages Snipes had already killed were in there. Snipes successfully blames the deaths on Stallone, so he gets sentenced to be frozen for 70 years. Snipes ends up escaping the cryo prison, so they thaw out Stallone to go hunt him down. That's sort of the whole theory here. Well, the helicopter pilot who took Stallone to go get Snipes in the beginning of the movie is still alive and on the police force even after these giant revolutions, but he's an old man now, and they have like a bro down moment. It's like, hey, how the fuck you doing? Hey, you look like shit. Hey, you know, just breaking balls like dudes do. And they like shake hands and pat each other on the back or whatever. And yeah, everyone else, because people don't touch each other or use vulgarity, everyone's looking on this like, what the hell just happened there? We've never seen this guy behave like this, this old man. And Sandra Bullock explains to the fat homosexual, oh, this is how insecure, or no, I don't think the fat homosexual is in the room at the time, but she explains to like somebody, oh, this is how insecure heterosexual men greet each other or something along those lines. And that's sort of the only overt bit of pause in the whole movie. But even at the time, in that era, you didn't have to qualify anything as heterosexuals.
Yeah.
Like, everything was just assumed heterosexual, and like fags weren't common enough for anyone to even need to use that qualifier yet. So that's actually a super paused up bit for its time.
It just really kind of stood out. Like, and I guess I like to try and date this stuff, at least for the Zoomers that tune in who didn't live through this era and so just don't know. Like, this is like when you first saw, because like it's actually kind of funny for like guys like you and me, because I know I'm younger than you, but like guys like you and me, like we saw like these changes happening in real time. We were in school or like had just gotten out of school when the stuff was like when the changes were really starting to be felt on the much smaller cultural level. This is like, now the Zoomers are just kind of like, they're ameliorated to it because they're born and bred in this. But mm-hmm. I mean, like, this is what, when you really started to hit like a masculinity explicitly under attack, where you, like, you had like, basically you had constantly had to have men qualifying themselves on their, especially on their sexuality.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was a before time, kids.
Yeah. Let's see here. The only, I have two things left, because I don't think we can close this episode out with talking about like how, like, this, because like when people talk about Demolition Man, they always talk about things it predicted, but I think we can save that for the end, because I don't think that's as big of a deal or anything. But like on the topic of the future, like what I found really kind of interesting about this is I kind of said that, like, there's like an accelerationist kind of perspective on this. Again, like I have to clarify this a lot. When I talk about accelerationism, I'm not talking about political or cultural accelerationism, especially in the term of the sea, is like let's make things worse so that we can get a political revolution or something like that. Like, that's not what I'm talking about. Accelerationism is kind of like is a technological thing of basically accelerate technology as quickly as possible, basically to get kind of things into a singularity so that you can avoid kind of a collapse, because like, this stuff's going to be quote unquote inevitable. So let's just get there now, you know, basically accelerate now and avoid the collapse more or less. But this movie, like one aspect of that is that technocrats are always figure very heavily. Capitalist technocrats always figure very heavily in this perspective of technological accelerationism. You have shades of that in this movie with Cocteau. Like basically he's engineered this hyper-capitalist society where basically Taco Bell is everything food related now. And like,
there's a reference to, what do they call it? The chain wars,
the franchise wars
that all restaurants went to war with one another. Taco Bell won, and now they are a monopoly on restaurants.
Well, that's the most absurd part of this movie. This idea of restaurants being at war with each other when what really happens is they all get bought under into one company. But
now I'm fucking starving.
They all get bought into one company and they keep the brand names just to, you know, maintain the illusion that there's a diversity of choices that you have, that there's like actual like different businesses, when what the reality is that the money's all going to the same place.
Yeah. What's hilarious about that take is Taco Bell isn't popular in Europe, but Pizza Hut is, and they're owned by the same company, Yum Brands. So if you watch the European version of this, it's done in a Pizza Hut. That scene is done in a Pizza Hut and they overdub the dialogue.
That's funny. But then you also like on this hyper-capitalist kind of accelerationist society, you also have what's the music that everybody loves that they consider to be oldies music.
They listen to old jingles.
Yeah, old jingles. And that's like that we are kind of moved, like we are like we're in that perspective in a media way already now. It's like what's all the media that people are watching now? It's like that they're basically just kind of trying to keep redoing the stuff that's already been done, because like that's like people have nostalgia for the old, you know, for all the old stuff and all the old media, but they're not creating anything new, and there's no genuine culture anymore. It's just the same thing. It's just the same old products being repackaged over and over again. And so like this is like, but this is what's oldies to these people is the original, like, because you have to imagine like if this is like, if they consider this to be the oldies, then whatever the current music is, like you would have to extrapolate then that's got to be current jingles. Like it's got to be because it's not, if this is what they consider to be the oldies music, then presumably the music they're listening to now is like more commercialized music, more commercialized jingles, and they like they prefer this stuff because they probably perceive this stuff like they probably perceive something more quaint and authentic and sincere in these old jingles, because like, that's what people always like what people always like tell themselves, were like oh man, I wish I had lived like in the 60s or 70s, like when everything was much more authentic and real. But it's,
well, I'll challenge everyone to I'll challenge everyone to give themselves a hard time here. Go on YouTube and watch a compilation of commercials and jingles from when you were a kid. You will have nostalgic feelings and you will have internal conflict about, oh no, why am I having this yearnful nostalgia for capitalistic sales pitches?
Have you ever seen did you ever watch Mad Men?
Yeah, love it.
So you know the carousel scene, right?
Yeah.
Here, I'll play I'll pull it up for Frank to play for people who've never seen it before, but like it that's exactly what we're talking about here. Play it from here it is. Like play it from about 35, I think let's say 30 seconds, Frank. Play it from there, but this is the problem with capitalism. Basically, like, they know like it's designed to basically there's the incentive is there to basically to find what tugs at the heartstring, what hits that dopamine part of the brain. Like there's a nostalgic part of the brain as well that it can tap into. It's like engineered to get these feelings into you, and as you progress further and further into the stuff, as they basically take you into a deeper layer of complexity into it, like you start to yearn for something that's more simpler before they were able to like make this even more complex. But the thing is, like, you're still trapped in this machine. Like it's like you're still like buying what they're selling you. You're just like yearning for an older version of it. That's what's terrifying about it, and it's so effective. Go ahead and play it, Frank.
There's the rare occasion when the public can be engaged on a level beyond flash if they have a sentimental bond with the product. My first job, I was in-house at a fur company with this old pro copywriter, Greek, named Teddy. And Teddy told me the most important idea in advertising is new. It creates an itch. You simply put your product in there as a kind of calamine lotion. But he also talked about a deeper bond with the product. Nostalgia. It's delicate, but potent. Sweetheart. Teddy told me that in Greek, nostalgia literally means the pain from an old wound. A twinge in your heart, far more powerful than memory alone. This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine. It goes backwards and forwards. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again. It's not called the wheel. It's called the carousel. It lets us travel the way a child travels. Around and around, and back home again. Place where we know we are loved.
Okay, you can stop it there. That's we get the gist of it. It's like, I mean, that's the insidious power of all this, because that's powerful stuff, and they can know how to sell that to you to the point like all you really yearn for are their products. And, you know, like, it's like, we like to laugh and say, like, you know, I'm, you know, excited, you know, consumed product, excited to consume next product. Like, that's, that is encoded into all of us now at this point, because, like, that's how deeply we are into the system. And actually, Jack in the chat here, wasn't aware of this. He said that this movie utilized the LA subway before it was open to the public. It was literally an advert for using the LA subway in movies. Just like, that's the level of, like, capitalism we're running on in this movie. Did I lose Jail? Oh, Jail's muted.
Sorry, yeah, I was muted. I'm watching that scene from Mad Men, and it's considered, like, one of the best dramatic scenes in television history. You know, you can kind of just say the carousel scene, and some people who never watched the show know what you're talking about. And all I can think when I watch that scene is, I will never forgive Duck Phillips for what he did to Chauncey.
Let's see here. Do I have, so I got, the only other, like, on that kind of level of hyper-capitalism. So, like, basically you have the city's more or less, one thing that, kind of, cause it didn't, like, I found it kind of silly when I first, like, when they kept saying, like, when they kept saying San, what did they call it? San Angeles.
Yeah.
Like, basically the, you know,
everything from San Diego to LA is one megalopolis now.
Yeah. Oh, that makes more sense, because I was thinking it was like that they had merged San Francisco and LA. I was like, damn, like, that is one, like, that is one major kind of, like, that's a Judge Dredd style, like,
right,
mega city right there. But that, yeah, San Diego and LA makes more sense merging those two together. And at first, like, I found, like, I don't know, like, I found it kind of weird and silly, but, like, the more I thought about it, like, that actually makes a lot more sense, where you have, like, that's, like, just how bad the urban sprawl has gotten. And actually, having only visited Southern California once, like, it was shocking to me, like, going out, like, that you can go out for miles and miles east from LA, and, like, it just doesn't, like, the suburbia just doesn't end. It just doesn't seem to end. Like, we're both from Metro Detroit. Like, it's like, we have, like, a lot of, like, kind of, like, sprawl here, but, like, once you get, like, after a certain point, like, you get into the exurb, it's not that far. Like, you can, like, if you start from the heart of Detroit, and, like, you drive out basically an hour in any direction that's not the river, you're going to probably eventually hit countryside, more or less.
Yeah.
But it's just, like, I remember being in Southern California, it's like, this just doesn't end. It just keeps going forever.
I didn't go east in LA. You know, I spent like a week in Southern California, almost a year ago, I guess, 6 months ago, something. And I had a really good experience with it, because I just kind of did touristy shit and went and looked at beaches. But I, you know, we went down into Hollywood, and it's all tourists there. So I didn't sort of, like, get to see a lot of LA, but I know everything I need to know. Like, if you've been to any major American city, yeah, that's all.
Yeah, but anyways, on that, it's like when I was bringing up, like, technological accelerations, like, that's, like, the kind of stuff, like, we talk, like, that people are kind of predicting, where you're going to have these mega cities, and you're going to have these basically technocrats that are ruling everything, and they dictate all the policies. That was actually one of the more fascinating, like, low key things that was happening. In Demolition Man, because, like, I was thinking partially, I guess I was one of the reasons why I kept thinking of San Francisco, because San Francisco is one of those cities that's basically being run by these tech corporations, these tech giants.
Yeah.
And then you have, like, this complete, like, trashy underclass that's underneath it all. And
we should actually mention that real quick. There's a group called the Scraps, and that's Dennis Leary's group. And they are all the people who are sort of resisting this not so Huxley-esque attempt to, like, pacify and civilize everyone who wants to be, like, a normal person of the old ways. They live in these, like, underground tunnels, and they have to, like, raid the surface for food.
Yeah. And that's the funniest thing I think about this, because, like, the city's portrayed as a, well, the movie portrays the society as a bit of a silly utopia. And then you have these people on the bottom that are choosing to live this way because they want personal freedom. Like, but none of that really makes sense, especially like when the society is very capitalist. Like what this would actually be is like, those are the people who are just losing out. That's just the underclass right there that are forced to eat rat burgers because they can't.
That was the only scene in the movie that actually made me laugh.
Yeah.
Stallone orders a burger and no one else, none of the surface people eat meat. And he's down there with two of these surface cops that are going to go rogue with him. And he orders a burger off this Mexican lady and he's eating it. And then they tell him it's a rat and he keeps eating it anyway. And his facial expression was pretty funny. That was the only lull I got out of this movie.
And then, well, yeah, he says, like, this is the best burger I've had in years, the joke being because he's been cryogenically frozen for so long. Yeah. But, I mean, like, in played correctly in this movie, like, these are not people who are choosing to live this way. These are people who are forced to live this way because this is not a utopia. It's an accelerated techno-capitalist society, which has, like, which the people who are, you know, living these lives up on the top, these sexless, like, because now the movie starts to make more sense when you view it this way. Like, it's the people on top that are living these sexless, pacifistic lives. Like, these are the bug men. These are the people who have completely divorced themselves of their humanity and are serving the system. And what they get in return is that they get to live in this much more peaceful, privileged access to gadgets and the like. They get to be a part of, like, they get to be closer to the people who are ruling over the city, and they're not part of the dirty underclass. Like, that's like, if this movie had been played correctly, that's what's really going on, more or less. Basically, I'm trying to, like, people are pointing out I say more or less too much, and I got to stop doing that.
Can I just point out a couple of, like, silly asides that I had in my notes? When am I going to get my 3D rendered spinning UIs and operating systems that were promised to me by all movies in the 90s that featured a computer? Like, I should have an operating system where I sort of, like, fly around buildings that I go in. When he's at this sort of computer, like, ATM looking thing, and he has been, like, imbued with hacker abilities, all 1990s operating systems and user interfaces on computers looked the same, and we never got one like that.
But I guess, just kind of wrap this up a little bit, like, at least on this point here, is I would love to see Demolition Man redone, because, like, I can take a lot of the stuff that we talk about, a lot of the piss earth stuff we talk about, can actually translate really well into this movie, where you have, like, these technocratic mega cities, you have these bug people, you have this underclass that's eating, instead of rat burgers, it'd be bug burgers. Like, you have that. Like, you could have, like, you know, there's no guns in the society, everyone's pacifistic and has no desire to, like, they don't engage in their power process, they don't have to drive to, like, they've been reduced basically to docile cattle. You can have things like, I'm trying to think of what else you could add to this that would basically go along with our narratives, but there's a lot of different things and then you have, like, these technocratic, you know, these tech billionaires that are represented by Cocteau, who's basically, in order to, you know, like, they're basically, they unleash criminals on the society in order to get, like, the policies that they, you know, want to push through, because there's nobody that's going to stop them. Like, you, like, the kind of, like, you know, basically creating anarcho tyranny. Like, this is, like, there's so many different ways recreate our narratives in this movie because of the movie it is. Like, it's obviously not going to touch those themes, but, like, if there was ever a movie that was ripe to be remade by our guys, like, Demolition Man would be the one.
Yeah, somebody in the chat, get on it. Go get yourself a big old Hollywood budget and remake this.
Because it's like, there is an implicit criticism of techno-capitalism and neoliberalism in this movie. I don't think I have really anything else on my specific notes on this kind of stuff. I did.
Well, did you hear the part where you got the shout out?
When
Wesley Snipes is in the museum? And the, like, people walk by in the Chinese looking hats, and he's like, "Oh, Chang Chang Chong Chong."
I was like,
"You got name checked in this one. That's why you wanted to do this episode." Yeah, the only other things I have in my notes are one that's also just sort of a silly aside is they always have like these really non-ergonomic things in sci-fi that are like inferior to what we have now, but they're trying to make everything look different for space. Like one thing that always bothered me is the flashlights in Star Trek's are just like a cube. Like that is less ergonomic and less wieldy than the flashlights we have now.
Yeah.
And they have like their iPhones in this movie and it has like a handle on it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the purpose of that stuff was always because like it's hard to take something that's like already like ergonomic to us and like make it look more futuristic without making it look really like hokey and corny in some way. So that's always been the problem of depicting the future in movies, that unless you have like the effects to be able to render something more like take what we have now and just render it more futuristic looking, you have to have it differentiated in some way that people understand, like, oh, this is an object of the future. That's always been a problem with any kind of science fiction movie. It's something that they can do, like the effects that they're able to do now, like this is actually to me like what special effects should be for, is where you're able to take something and make it look like, and basically able to make it more realistic to what you're actually trying to depict, instead of having to deal with that movie problem. Was like, well, the audience needs to understand that this is different and futuristic, but we have to do it in a way that makes it stand out.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the last thing would be like this movie's, I mentioned that this movie is frequently mentioned because of the stuff it predicted. So I got a list here. Some 10 things the film Demolition Man predicted. Arnie's political career. That's like when people bring up Demolition Man, that's the thing that people usually bring up, is that the 61st Amendment, the Schwarzenegger Amendment, is what removed the immigration restriction on the president, which really begs the question, like especially like where we are now, like it really begs the question, like what were in the other 40 amendments how do they wait until 61 to make that happen? Like what was in the other 30 to 40 that they had to push through?
Yeah. Like, the no-sex amendment.
Yeah.
The no spicy food amendment.
Yeah, because like that's like, to be honest, that's like if the next amendment we're going to more than likely, if it's not the Equal Rights Amendment or anything like that, like the next amendment we're going to get to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, is going to be the one that removes the restrictions on immigrants running for the presidency. The rise of video calling. That was actually really cool. They kind of had prefiguring the iPad with FaceTime. I thought that was interesting that they got that one right. Although I guess that one's kind of a no-brainer. It was something that people have always wanted. So self-driving cars, I think that one's kind of a no-brainer. Taco Bell, obviously. Like this kind of like product placement I've always hated, like where it's basically like we're going to be it's okay for this kind of egregious product placement if we're like self-aware about it. Like I hate that shit a lot. Like, implying that, just as long as you draw attention to it, that makes it okay. I didn't know about this, but to celebrate the film's 25th anniversary, Taco Bell recreated the 2032 San Angeles version of their restaurant at the 2018 San Diego Comic-Con. Because like that's what ends up happening, is that they just like they're able to make bank on this, and they're able to perpetually resell their references to a movie you knew right back to you. It's just like constantly commodifying this stuff. Let's see here. Wesley Snipes is a hardened criminal.
Oh, come on.
Teleconferences, I think that's a no-brainer there. Biometric implants. Everyone in the shiny utopia that is future LA has an implant that uses ID as medical trackers and a virtual wallet. Tablet computers, I mentioned that. Voice-activated appliances, that seems to be a kind of a no-brainer. And then
these sound to me like things every futuristic sci-fi movie predicted, though.
Yeah, YouTube instructional videos. The police have to resort to an instructional video to find out how to arrest a maniac. That was
actually, that
was pretty funny. Well, I forgot about this one. Like right before Wesley Snipes starts getting the constant tickets for swearing, like there's that guy at the public video computer that basically you have these computers that are functioning as both kind of like a Myers-Briggs test and a self-esteem therapy for people. Like that's actually like a more prescient prediction, where like where people, because they're so atomized and depressed and deracinated in all of these things, that they're looking to these technologies to basically comfort them and give them some form of therapy.
Because it's the women who post retarded platitude memes on Facebook.
Yeah.
Instead of like asking the computer to give me some sort of compliment or affirmation, I have, you know, some wine mom with any of these useless platitude memes about, they're going to tell you you're not enough, but you're going to go take the world by the, not by the balls. I'm not good at feminine platitudes. I'm sorry, but I think everyone knows what I'm talking about.
Take life by the horns or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then like you also have the way that sex and reproduction are like that. It was kind of funny to me, like seeing this today, because this is my first time seeing it, like the way like sex and reproduction is outlawed and how separated it is from everything else. Because I was in a debate today about transhumanism. And one of the things I ended up mentioning, because the person I was talking to, Aiden Paladin, was, I forgot why she brought it up, but like the whole like aspect of like of reproduction. Oh yeah, it's like she was bringing up like the human drives, and she was, one thing she was kind of pondering about was the reproductive aspect, the reproductive drive of human beings, like how that figures into transhumanism. And there's a book, I'm gonna spoil it again for people, like just kind of skip this part if you don't want me to spoil Elementary Particles. But in Michel Houellebecq's novel Elementary Particles, the epilogue to all of this is that one of the characters who's been like so traumatized by like his mother's his mother basically being a slut, and just like this how ever present sexuality is in the world, that he's like turned inward and wanted to like pursue a more scientific approach. His research into this stuff inspires a guy to basically be able to perfect human cloning and separate sex and reproduction once and for all. And he ends up creating the society that is completely like reproduced without the use of sex, which is considered like an outdated form of all this reproduction, with all the nasty parts of it, like all the things that people dislike, of like how disruptive it is to people's lives removed from that. And like that's like, I kept feeling like echoes of that when I was watching this thing, where people are like, this is like the low-key theme of this movie, is people are so divorced from the power process, from the need to struggle as a human being. They're so divorced from what it is to be a living, breathing creature, that they are removed from all these natural impulses. And that's a theme that comes up constantly in stuff like Brave New World and Elementary Particles and the like, where like this is the direction like that technology, like people are all aware that this is the direction that technology is taking us into. And it's like, it's one, like I know Mike brings up Childhood's End a lot, which is like I always enjoy when he does that, because that was one of the novels I read in high school that always stuck with me, is that these like, I feels like that we put the stuff in depictions of technology that feels like a future echo to me as well. Like everyone perceives that technology is not going to make our lives better, that it's going to remove all of our natural impulses, that we keep depicting this happening in our fiction tells me like we instinctively understand like technology is not taking us in a good direction.
Yeah, I agree. And sometimes it comes in a simpler form than what you thought it was. Maybe we don't need, you know, helmets where we have like telepathic smile sex with each other. We have porn. We have infinite porn.
Yeah.
You know, we don't need a machine that's going to tell us we're good enough, we're smart enough, and God darn it, people like us. We have dumb platitudes on Facebook.
Yeah. ASMR videos like for simulated intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like everything's becoming compartmentalized, and it's like that's what I found fascinating about Demolition Man, because it's not a good movie.
So what you're trying to say is that the Industrial Revolution
and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race. No, it's, I mean, like, I try to avoid making, like, I'm becoming a broken record, honestly. I talk about technology on every single podcast I'm on, every single episode now. I'm trying to avoid doing this, but like, once you like start to see this stuff, like you see it everywhere, especially because like we're becoming more technologically advanced, and like technology is the center question of all this. Like, what else? Like, how can you not talk about this? Like, how can you not like look at this in the, you know, square in the eye and not see this for what's going on? Like, that's what I found. Like, so I guess this is a good point to like talk about, like, do we recommend this movie? Because I'm making this movie, I think, sound more interesting than it actually is. Like, there's themes in this that I'm pulling out from, but because these are the topics I'm interested in. Like, I'm basically like, it's like you gave me a pile of chicken wings and I'm just trying to get every piece of meat that's on that thing. you're looking at me bored. So I'm like, no, like you've gotten all the meat on that bone. There's no more meat to be had. Leave it alone.
Yeah. I'll tell you this. I can't recommend this movie because it's just not very good. But they did get me. As soon as we're done here, I'm taking my wife to Taco Bell.
Oh my God. Oh yeah, no, they got me too, because I'm staying at my parents this weekend for Memorial Day, and my dad calls me up and says, like, what do you, while I'm watching this movie, and he asked me, like, what do you want for dinner? And I almost said Taco Bell. They almost got me too. We ended up getting cheesesteaks instead, but I almost said Taco Bell.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I don't know when the last time I had Taco Bell was, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to regret it.
Yeah. Oh, man. But I don't, if you want to, if you're in a dumb action movie mood, and you want to see a movie that's got a bunch of, you know, like the dumbest kind of action one-liners, then it's okay for that. But I can't recommend Demolition Man beyond kind of that. Like, if you are intrigued enough though, like, I want to overanalyze a movie like Borzoi does, then I guess you could do that. But like, those are like, these are, that's, I just can't recommend this movie. Like, I think there's better things you can do with your time. But if you want a dumb action movie, well, there you go. I guess a throwback to the 90s, you can make that work. But I don't really have anything else. So this is going to be the pause button for this week. For people who kind of follow me for the episodes on Tuesday, we're not going to be doing a Tuesday episode. We're releasing this one early just so people have content for Memorial Day. I don't know what the next week's going to be. Like, I got a donation in for a documentary that's kind of related to the Franklin cover-up, the Franklin scandal. I'm going to see if I can get Nick Mason on for that one, because I think he'd be perfect for that. So in which case, I don't know when we're going to be able to record that one, because his schedule's kind of really wonky, and like, we have to schedule it around when he's available. But I don't know, like, if you guys want to donate, my docket's pretty free, so if anybody wants to donate and hear my hot takes on whatever bizarre thing you want me to watch.
Is this still the case that when people buy an episode, they can suggest a co-host? Obviously, that co-host isn't bound, but I know that a lot of people have wanted me to do Zulu, that kind of stuff. So that's still an option people can do. Like, oh, well, I'd really like to hear so-and-so's take on X movie.
Here's the thing about donations, and because I take the donation episodes very seriously. Like, I stress myself out over this stuff constantly. Because the payer, the consumer, are putting up your money, and like, I have a steep barrier to entry on this stuff, so I take this stuff seriously. Any recommendations, suggestions you give me for like that episode, I will take, like, whether that's a guest suggestion or topics you want me to cover. Like, I take all that stuff under consideration, and I try to incorporate it as much as possible. And I try to deliver the best possible episode I can. So, like, thankfully it's never happened. Everyone's been satisfied with the episodes I've delivered. But if like I botch an episode so badly, like it's like you didn't even think it was worth it, I'll give you like another. I'll take another shot at either that or another or a different movie if you want. Like, I want to make sure people feel like they're getting their bang for their buck.
Yeah,
like, you're
a guy
you're,
in the chat,
you're paying me to, you're basically, you really are paying me like to do a good job. I'm gonna do a good job.
Yeah, guy in the chat asks how much. What is it? Minimum is $100. And if it's going to be a ton of work or it's something that you're really not interested in, the price goes up.
Yeah, basically. So price also goes up if I have a heavy docket and you want to hear it sooner. Because I have a pretty clear docket right now, it's basically minimum $100 for anything that's kind of standard. The more I'm interested in it, the more that stays at that price. If it's something I'm not really interested in doing, I'm going to bump the price up. If it's something that's like a TV show where I have to watch a bunch of episodes or something that's going to take me more than just like 2 to 3 hours to watch it, like I'm going to have to increase it. Like just the more difficult you make things for me, the higher the price goes. But right now, $100 is my standard price for an episode.
Right on.
Yep.
Borzoi out here doing some capitalisms.
After shitting on capitalism for 90 minutes, I'm doing a capitalism. But follow me on Twitter at Asian Wolfhound, and I think that's about. You like that?
You're an asshole.
What? 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 I think that's a great Twitter name.
No, it is. It is.
It's and you do you know what name I'm going by on there? I'm Edward B. Chang on that. Yeah, which is the name that Media Matters doxed me with.
Yeah, but, poor kid.
But that I think that's quite enough. So with that, I'm gonna push the pause button on this.